to the incredible suffering.
But I
and
think
it's
they
just,
do link. I mean, I just think they don't care. I think that
well,
they're
maybe,
willing
maybe,
to.
Maybe Trump doesn't care.
I mean, definitely not. Yeah, definitely not.
You know, Trump doesn't care. Some, you know, some of these members, they, yeah, some of them don't care, but some of them, it's just a willful moral blindness that. They don't want to deal with it, don't want to read it, they don't want to confront it.
Yeah, or just the money is more important to them then. I think for most of them, because you'd have to be so ignorant. I mean, money is more important than children's lives. And, you know, it, over 80,000 children in Yemen have been starved to death. And I think these people, I'll say it, you don't have to say it so you don't have awkward interactions in Washington. But I think, you know, these people just have blood on their hands.
I guess I tend to still be an optimist about humanity and hope that we can get people to see the right thing. Though I've got to tell you, Trump's statement on Yemen was an insight probably in how some of these folks think, because usually when Mattis or even Pompeo speak, they give lip service to human rights and they say, oh, the humanitarian condition was improving. I mean, Trump's statement was basically, yes, they're killing people. Yes, it's awful. It's an awful world. And we're going to support them anyway because we get money from Saudi Arabia. I mean, it was almost brutally honest about how some people view the world.
Yeah, I think most people, I think most Republicans, I think most politicians honestly view it that way, sadly. And I actually had an Intercept journalist, John Schwartz, come on the show because he had written a piece about the honesty. He kind of jokingly said, this Thanksgiving, I'm happy for Trump, the most honest president. And we obviously acknowledge that he's he lies constantly. But he also does something that other people don't. He really offers, he takes the mask off politics. Because
he does. I mean, he's he's providing basically the crude explanation for realpolitik or power-based view of foreign policy. And in some ways, the situation in Yemen is linked to the situation of tear gassing of folks throwing rocks around the border. And the
Mexico.
Reason they're linked is, we have to fundamentally ask a basic question in this country, and that is, if we believe in our Declaration of Independence that all human beings are created equal, do we believe that there are such things as rights for non-Americans? And I really think that that is it's a question the Supreme Court really hasn't weighed in on. What are the rights of people overseas? And you look at the America First rhetoric, and there's just the sense that those rights don't matter. And what matters is just the rights of Americans. And I think those of us who believe in human rights say, no, the rights of people overseas, they're human beings with infinite human worth, just like any human being born in the United States.
Right, yeah. So, human rights don't stop at a border.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, the United States has caused so much of the instability and violence that people are fleeing,
certainly in Honduras. Yes.
Yes.
And Guatemala, of course. I mean, it's a terrible history. And because of our obsession in the Cold War to prevent communism in any place, we aligned with militias and really
death
bad
squads
actors.
And even the more recent coup in Honduras. Just wanted to say that was Donald Shaw at Sludge. The Sludge analysis shows that lawmakers with large campaign contributions from the defense industry are more likely to defend the U.S. military's relationship with Saudi Arabia. Anything? What about what you're doing now? The Progressive Caucus, you and others have said you'll take no contributions from oil companies. That is Congressman Ro Khanna, who is a U.S. representative from California's 17th Congressional District. You're listening to The Katie Halper Show. You can hear The Katie Halper Show every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WBAI. That's 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. I spoke to Representative Khanna earlier in the day because that was the only time he was free, and he is a busy congressman. Also, since speaking to Ro Khanna, very exciting thing happened. which is that, as Bernie Sanders put it on his Twitter feed, for the first time, the U.S. Senate just voted to advance a resolution withdrawing U.S. armed forces from an unauthorized and unconstitutional war. Let us bring this catastrophic war in Yemen to an end and help bring peace and humanitarian aid to this tortured country.
Yes, I mean, I take no contribution from any political action committee or lobbyist.
Right. So that definition includes
oil companies. But we have many new members who are saying at least they won't take fossil fuel money. And I've been supporting Ocasio-Cortez's call for a select committee on green new jobs for two reasons. One, we need to show that there's an urgency to this climate change issue, and it can't move at the glacial speed that some of these committees in Congress move at. Secondly, we need to link environmental legislation to jobs, and there's a great win-win. We can say, look, we can put people back to work in rural America, in communities left behind, in minority communities, doing the work of building a clean energy future, building an energy efficiency future, and that tackling climate change can be a win for putting America back to work. I know that that's a strong message that will resonate across this country, and I think it puts us on the offensive politically on climate change instead of always being on the defensive where the Republicans say, oh, they're killing jobs.
Right. And also, it's pretty, as you pointed out, I mean, it's pretty expensive to deal with these climate disasters.
It is, and it's real now. I mean, it's no longer abstract. You have these awful wildfires in my home state in California, which are, of course, linked to climate change. You've had hurricanes because of warming of water that are far more severe. I mean, people understand that the weather patterns have led to far more severe catastrophic climate events, and this is something that's affecting people. The crops are being affected. There, different animals in different communities are being affected. Fishing is being affected. So I think this has gone from an abstraction to something that ordinary Americans are experiencing. Of course, there's still the ignorance, and people, you still hear among colleagues, someone will say, oh, but I could use a little bit of climate change.
Yeah.
I've got to, you know, my winters are too cold.
Right.
And the problem is there's still ignorance, but people say, how do we overcome that? I said, ignorance has probably been a defining characteristic through a lot of history.
Right.
I mean, there was ignorance at the time of Copernicus and Galileo, and they fighting on the side of reason and truth is never easy, and it requires great persistence. But the history of humanity still shows eventually truth and reason win. So the question is, will it win fast enough in this case
for us to survive,
given the imminent crisis?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is hopefully people will realize, the wealthy will realize that, you know, of course there's environmental racism, environmental classism, that kind of haves and have-nots experience these things differently, but ultimately everyone's going to suffer the climate disasters. So I think hopefully they'll realize.
I mean, the challenge is that those who are wealthy are more insulated from the impact initially, right? I mean, the people who suffered the most in the wildfires were the elderly in communities where they couldn't leave. And if you're wealthy and aren't living in those type of communities, you don't feel the impact quite as much. But ultimately, even the wealthy are facing the economic consequences. And so we just have to hope that the powerful interests in this country realize that this is something that's going to affect all of humanity.
Right, and not just economic. I mean, it's a question of survival, right? I mean, again, like, the wealthy are more insulated, but ultimately, if waters rise, you know, they have to, you know, the environment is something that at some point becomes equal opportunity if, like, the planet is no longer livable.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you linked to, this is fascinating, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, published something, the unresolved issue of Verizon throttling Santa Clara's fire department shows why ISPs need rules. Can you talk about that?
I don't know if you saw that, but firefighters who were fighting these California wildfires weren't allowed to have access to the internet that they needed.
So
there's a classic case of throttling, and it's a case of why the internet is a common carrier under Title II of the Communications Act. I mean, if telephones were regulated because people felt that everyone should have access to a telephone, the internet is the same way. Imagine if a phone company didn't allow a firefighter or an ambulance to make a phone call. There would be outrage. Well, we should have the same outrage that people didn't have access, rescuers and first responders didn't have access to the internet. And all net neutrality says is that type of action is illegal, that internet service providers are common carriers like telephone companies, that they have a public responsibility.
Right. I mean, it's a public safety issue.
It's a public safety issue, and it's a public grant. We're giving them the
right
space, the land to put their wires that are transmitting this information. That's a public grant that the United States is giving them.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think, again, it's insane how overtly people will put profits before human lives. I mean, these are firefighters trying to put out fires, which kill people.
Yes.
And then you have called for Bernie Sanders to run for president.
I have. I think he will be transformational in terms of his economic message and his foreign policy message. He can link foreign policy populism with economic populism and redefine this nation to return to our founding ideals. And really, I view him as a transformational figure. And if he were president, we could do a lot of good for this nation and the world.
Yeah. And what do you say? I mean, I think that he's the most electable against Trump for many reasons. You know, he's outside of the political beltway culture. He appeals to a lot of the anti-status quo desire that people have. He's extremely consistent. I mean, the media has already started the smears against him, or you know, I shouldn't say that, they haven't let up. The smears that started during the primary. Do you have any responses to the claims, to the arguments against him?
I've always been amazed by the vitriol against him. I mean, I had people talking about running against me because I was supporting or suggesting Bernie Sanders. And I said to them, think about this. There's 30 or 40 people who are going to run for president. That means there are going to be Democrats supporting 30 or 40 different candidates. Why wouldn't you just let everyone support the candidate they like? And then we can all come together. At least I plan to, once there's a nominee.
Sure.
If it's not
right.
Bernie Sanders, I would support the person. But there's this, if I had tweeted out that I support, Kirsten Gillibrand
right.
or Cory Booker or Kamala Harris or Beto O'Rourke or any of these other people, I wouldn't have had that kind of vitriol
right.
by some of these folks. And so I don't understand it, other than to think that Sanders hasn't played the career game.
Right.
He's not a flatterer by disposition,
yeah.
and he's probably a threat to certain established power centers.
I think he is. And the irony, though, of course, is that, I mean, I think the primary would be hard for him, but the general, I think he'd do so much better in. And people don't remember, either don't remember, don't understand, or are just being disingenuous when they say, oh, he didn't win the primary, how can he win a general? Don't they understand that different people vote in the general, that independents are growing, and that he has more reach, he has more crossover appeal?
And I think his message really will resonate in
yeah.
places like Michigan,
exactly.
Wisconsin, Ohio, Minnesota, and those
right,
are the states.
The Rust Belt.
Look, Florida, I hope we win, but Florida is still, as this election showed, is still a tough state,
right.
and Ohio is still tough. So that means we're really going to have to win the Midwest. We're
yes.
going to have to win Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota. And I think Sanders resonates
yes,
in those areas.
Yeah. I think he's, I really do think he's, I mean, I keep saying this, I love Sanders, I love his politics, I love his policies, I love his style as a New Yorker, but that aside, he's, to me, it's so strikingly obvious that he's the most viable opponent to Donald Trump. I had Nathan Robinson, who's the editor and founder of Current Affairs, which is a great magazine. And he has a very great, I'll send it to you. He has a great article where he just goes through all the reasons Sanders is the only one who can beat Trump. He goes through the other alternatives.
Yeah.
And he says the one thing is the age thing. But he, as he pointed out, first of all, Sanders only 4 years older than Trump. And he's so much more fit than Trump. And Nathan said that if Trump tries to play the age card with him, that Sanders should just challenge him to a game of one-on-one basketball, which I think would be a great idea.
I wouldn't want to play Sanders in one-on-one basketball.
Exactly.
But then basketball is not exactly a strong suit for me.
Right.
But
You're very tall. You're very tall. You have that.
Yeah, well, that's my ability to jump is not great. But but Sanders has got, you know, he is very athletic and he runs and he's in great shape.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this: who else do you think is going to be a strong contender for the nomination?
I mean, strong contender for the nomination as opposed to a strong candidate. Like in the primary, I don't honestly. I mean, who like there's Gillibrand. There's I think Gillibrand maybe Warren, but I think she really. I think she, for better or for worse, I think the DNA issue with Native American heritage really was a setback for her. It was just bad PR.
And what do you make of all this buzz around Beto? And I know some of the Sanders folks.
You know, it's funny. Oh, there was one of the smears that came from, of course, New York Times. I don't know if you saw it. It says, like, Sanders, you know, is a progressive lion, but his roar isn't as loud or something. And it made the ridiculous argument that he's being outflanked on the left by Ayanna Pressley, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Beto O'Rourke. Now, yeah, I mean, I tweeted the other day, there's a picture of no disrespect, Beto, and I know there's a lot of, I mean, sucking up to Israel.
Look, like Beto, I did the No Pet Caucus, but Beto is fairly moderated in his voting.
Yeah.
He voted for TPP and other things.
Exactly.
I supported it very, very strongly
against Cruz.
But there's a difference between that and what's progressive in Texas and what's progressive in the nation.
Right. And there's I tweeted a photo of him meeting with AIPAC people talking about the special relationship with Israel. And I was like, here's Beto, outflanking Sanders on the left, apparently. And then, of course, I mean, Ocasio-Cortez is amazing, but she's just started. She's not going to run for president. Ayanna Pressley, most people don't know who she is. She doesn't have any name recognition. And Beto just lost. I mean, he did a wonderful job, but he lost his race.
Right.
So
there's an effectiveness that Sanders has, and I've now worked with him on a number of issues, on the prescription drug bill, on the Amazon bill, on the Walmart bill, on Yemen. And ultimately, I think what moves people about Sanders is not just the rhetoric, it's the fact that he has a record of an extraordinary amount of accomplishment over 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
And you people, I believe, and this could be just my bias, I think post-Trump people are going to be looking for substance. They're not going to just want someone who gives a good speech or inspiration or someone who can be a sensation in the media or social media.
Right.
I think they're going to want to know, what do you stand for? What specifically are you going to change about our economic and our foreign policy vision? I obviously am very supportive of Sanders, but I actually give Elizabeth Warren, even though there are places I disagree, I think she's also has a substantive sort of approach. But to me, the substance is really going to be matter post-Trump.
It's also I really think, for better or for worse, elections are based on affect and they are kind of popularity contests. And I think Sanders exudes, and this is why he's a threat, and this is why there's vitriol, he exudes authenticity and consistency. And you see him, you could do like a mashup, a montage of him saying the same things in like starting in the 70s, and of course in the 80s. And he doesn't, I think that people, I really think that, there are people who would have voted for him and then voted for Trump. And people use that against Sanders, which is ridiculous, because what Sanders does is he speaks to many audiences, but one of those audiences are the kind of the disaffected, disgruntled people who feel like the system isn't working and they voted for Trump. But of course, and Trump speaks to them too. The difference is Sanders is not lying, Trump is. And the big difference is that Sanders is saying blame, you know, inequality, blame the billionaires, you know, blame greed. And Trump is saying blame Muslims and Mexicans. And that's a huge difference. And I think that the fact that they speak to an overlapping crowd and take them in totally different directions is so important. And you talked about the Rust Belt appeal that he has. And, you know, there was something so moving when he was doing those town halls with Chris Hayes, and he did one with coal miners. And you saw him.
That.
You saw him transform a person on stage, someone who said something anti-immigrant, I think called them aliens, and you saw him make the case. He didn't treat this person with contempt. He didn't call the person, you know, a racist bigot. He just made his case, spoke to her on her level where she was at, and you saw her literally change right there on the stage. And you know, I think he just has an ability to speak to people. He has a very regular, down-to-earth affect. And I think people, I really do think that he and Trump both are anti-status quo, although he really is, and Trump in many ways is not. But they both are seen as people who violate taboos and say the things that no other people will say. And I really think he's just, again, I love him and I love his politics. But even that aside, I mean, there are people whose politics I love, but they wouldn't be as great, as competitive against Trump. I just think he really is the only person who has a chance beating him.
Well, I agree with all what you said, other than maybe the last part. I'm hoping that if by some chance he's not the nominee, we still can defeat Donald Trump.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah.
But I certainly agree with you that he has this crossover appeal, and that's a good thing. I mean, look,
of course it's a good thing. That's
the
how
fact
you win.
That Trump voters may support Sanders, I thought that's exactly in part what we need. No, that's what Obama had, right?
Right.
Obama had, there were a lot of people who voted for Obama and Trump, and there were a lot of people that Obama was able to get who voted for Trump. So if we have another candidate who could get Trump voters, it seems that's a good thing. No one would say Obama was wrong or right. compromise who he was by getting Trump voters.
Right. I mean, it's absurd. That is the one. That's how you win elections, is that you compete with. And the other issue is that there's this very, I don't know how mainstream it is. It's very much on Twitter, but there's this narrative that when you go for the coal miners, you're throwing other people under the bus. You're throwing people of color and women and LGBTQ people under the bus. And it's simply not true. There's not a single thing that Sanders or the real progressive left advocates that doesn't help, disproportionately help people of color, women, LGBTQ. It helps everyone, but it helps them even more. It's a very dangerous narrative. I don't know how popular it is again off the internet, but I think it's...
Yeah, I don't think anyone of good faith can doubt Senator Sanders' commitment to civil rights, and he's acknowledged that he needs to surround himself with people of diverse backgrounds,
right,
and speak more inclusively about those issues. I think it's refreshing. I think it's introspective, and
right,
all of us have blind spots. I mean, in my case, I was on panels, and someone on my team said, "Do you realize that this is the fourth panel you've done where they have all men?" And
right,
it just didn't even occur to me. And so then we made a change. I said, "Okay, I'm not going to do panel discussions now if there's not diversity." So
I think
what's important is the introspective ability, and I think Sanders has shown that.
Yeah, and being open. And, you know, when there was a Black Lives Matter protest, he kind of immediately put out a great criminal justice and racial justice platform back in the primaries. No, but yeah, I think that there's, you know, he doesn't, his, of course, maybe his language on some things could be improved, but he also, I think, I mean, again, I had a guest on Liza Featherstone who made the point that given how much people follow what he says and given how much the media hates him and opposes him, it's amazing he doesn't have more gaffes, given that any time he says something that's at all remotely problematic, and often it's just manipulated and it's not problematic, it's amazing he doesn't have more of those things, because there's just like they watch him like a hawk. One example is how he said something about moving beyond identity politics. And his whole point in saying beyond was saying we need diversity, but it's not enough. He wasn't saying we don't need diversity. I wrote something on this. I can send it to you. But it was a total distortion of what he said. It was the opposite. You know, they made it seem like he was dismissing it. He was saying, no, we need the diversity. And on top of that, we need the policy that helps these communities. The media coverage and bias of him is really outrageous. You have the New York Times changing a headline and changing the content of an article. And then this is just an interesting thing that happened. They were caught doing stealth editing, which is when you edit something without acknowledging it. You know, you don't say at the end of the article that originally this said blah, blah, blah. The public editor condemned it, said it was inappropriate. And the senior editors at the New York Times defended it.
What was this? Now I didn't follow
This was a piece that was published. It was called, the original headline was something like Sanders gains victories through legislative side doors. Let me just check this. Side doors. New York Times. Let's see. They changed the headline. And so it was, instead of starting with that, it basically was like, hold on one second. Okay. So it was, it started off with Bernie Sanders won victories via legislative side doors. And then they changed it to via legislative side doors, Bernie Sanders won modest victories. So they changed the order of it. And so like the first thing you see is no longer that he won victories. And they added the modest to it. They also edited the content of it. They took out a Jeff Weaver quote, which kind of was flattering of Sanders. They also, John McCain had made a comment about how Bernie Sanders was similar in some ways to the Tea Party Republicans, because instead of doing full full pieces of legislation, he would tweak it. You mean he's called the Amendment King, right? So John McCain made that point, but they took out his explanation of it and just had him say he's like the Tea Party. They also a line describing Sanders' legislative approach as the liberal mirror image of the Tea Party, right, was edited. So it had said the liberal mirror image of the Tea Party Republicans who oppose large-scale legislation, that was edited, so it was just the liberal mirror image of the Tea Party Republicans. They added a phrase about how he was at the margins. It was really amazing. So they made these changes, and then they didn't acknowledge them, and then they defended not acknowledging them. And again, the public editor at the Times said that it was inappropriate to do that. So, yeah, people have to be on the lookout for this stuff. I mean, we have then, there was another thing where they pretended that Jane Sanders, when she was ambushed by Arpaio, I don't know if you remember this, she was looking at Tent City. She was looking at it with Eric Andiola, who's was Bernie's Latinx press secretary and a major immigration activist. She saved her mother from being deported. She is from Arizona, and she was showing Jane Sanders the Tent City, and she got ambushed by Joe Arpaio, and people pretended that she had done a photo op with him and was posing with him, which is just absurd. So,
I think we need to make sure that the press is treating him fairly, but I also think that the world has changed and that social media and grassroots activists have a lot more influence and now can get information directly, and probably having a few negative lines in articles don't matter nearly as much as they used to, which is a good thing. And I think if Senator Sanders wins, it's going to be because of activists and bloggers and independent journalists like yourself who help him get his message across directly to people.
Well, you're more of an optimist than I am, because I think that sadly those media narratives do have a big effect. But as you're saying, I think you're right. We need to just challenge that. And of course, I think they have to be discredited. And the bias needs to be exposed. I think once we expose the bias effectively, people will be more skeptical of it. So I think that's really important. But thank you so much, Congressman Khanna. Thank you so much for speaking to me again. And
it's always a pleasure.
Yeah,
thank you for your work. Thank you for being such a strong voice for the progressive movement.
Oh, thank you.
All right.
That is Congressman Ro Khanna, who is a U.S. representative from California's 17th Congressional District. Thanks so much for listening to The Katie Halper Show. You can hear The Katie Halper Show every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WBAI. That's 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. See you next week.
Hi, I'm Wuyi Jacobs, host of Afrobeat Radio, where we discuss politics, current affairs, music, arts and culture from an African perspective on Wednesdays 10 p.m. to midnight. I invite you to join me every third Wednesday of the month to a live audience broadcast event from 9 p.m. to after midnight at the Brooklyn Commons, 388 Atlantic Avenue, featuring dance, music, food and beverages, interesting topics, innovators, and pop-up markets. To participate, visit www.afrobeatradio.com and click on Connect, or look up hashtag Afrobeat Radio.
November is National Native American Heritage Month. So come spend the evening with me, John Cain, from WBAI's Let's Talk on Thursday, November 29th at 7 p.m. I will be hosting a free screening of Even the Rain, a powerful film that demonstrates the brutal acts committed against Native peoples by Columbus and his men, and the violence and exploitation that continues even now. This Spanish language film layers history, racism, and the plight of indigenous peoples in a unique plot that recreates the past and strikes at the issues of today. And I want to extend a special invitation to our Spanish-speaking friends to help us catch all the nuances of the film. So come celebrate our special month by joining us at the Brooklyn Commons, 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, New York. That's Thursday, November 29th, 7 p.m. for Even the Rain.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI New York. It's 8 o'clock, time once again for Off the Hook.
Ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. From Billy Bump for the best, expect the worst. I hope that's understood. From Billy Bump. We'll be right back.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Alex.
Good evening.
And Kyle.
Yes, I'm also here.
Well, we have some interesting things to talk about tonight. Rob, I believe you have some kind of a late-breaking story involving that neo-Nazi group called the Proud Boys. What exactly happened to them today?
Yeah, this story is breaking right now. It's pretty entertaining, actually. They released a set of their bylaws, heavily redacted, to the public in conjunction with a apparently racist lawyer they're working with, but it's in the form of a PDF. Uh-huh. And if you look at it, it's got a lot of details, such as members' names and certain bylaws redacted with black stripes, like you would see on any manner of redacted documents. But
when you don't want somebody to read something,
right? When
you put a line through it.
Yes, exactly.
Makes sense. Yes, absolutely. Nobody can read it.
Nobody can read it. Uh-huh. In this case, unless they highlight the missing text, which is still there. It's just written in black on black. So many organizations have made the same mistake when releasing redacted material.
10 years ago.
10 years ago. Yes, people. Have figured out PDFs a bit more since then, except apparently Boys. So
Proud Boys, you can't be proud anymore.
So they've got
you
a bunch
have to be
of
ashamed of yourself.
So there's a bunch of personal identifying information with members of their organization.
And we're printing it out right now. So what do we have so far? We have their names, address, what, everything that
it looks like we've got names and other identifying info. I'm going through a story about it right now.
Well,
and
more toner then.
More
sorry.
Toner. Yes.
These are problems we shouldn't be worried about. Okay.
But there are also rules about like there is a particular rule regarding how many times they are allowed to self-pleasure each month. Family show, I know, but
we don't need to know certain things.
No, we didn't, and that maybe should have stayed redacted. But
let's re-redact that.
Yeah, but just go back and mute that part of the MP3 file if you're listening to this later. But yeah, and there's a bunch of a bunch of personal identifying information regarding members of this organization who maybe didn't want that info out there.
Alex.
Yeah, let me give everybody a practical tip here when it comes to the redaction of documents, okay? Because this happens all the time litigation.
Mm-hmm.
People have a lot of problems with redacting PDFs. They put annotated black boxes on them, and then if you can move those black boxes if the PDF isn't flattened. A very easy trick to getting around this problem is you redact the document, let's say you make these black boxes, whatever it is, and then just take a screenshot of the page as it's redacted, which ensures that the entire image is flattened. And nobody can then, highlight your text because you've essentially just taken an image of the redacted PDF itself. Nobody can ever get behind that particular method of redaction. You know, that's I think the really only surefire way to do that. When you take an image, it makes it into a screenshot, it makes it into a JPEG. Then you can essentially save the JPEG as a PDF if you really need a PDF. But this happens constantly, I have to say. And really, that's the only way I've found to get around this. I'd be curious to hear from listeners if they have any other innovative methodologies to prevent this from happening, to make the Proud Boys proud.
Or a glue stick, and if you cut the letters out of magazines, you can reprint it in a way that no one will know what the original source was.
Maybe we just shouldn't be giving any more tips and hints. Maybe this is Darwinism, and we just have to let it play out.
Why were they releasing this anyway? Was this like some kind of transparent thing where they wanted people to know how great their organization was or something?
It seems to be that sort of thing. But but in the process, they revealed, I think, their disorganization.
Well, the idea that they have bylaws is what, strikes me as extraordinarily odd. They don't seem to be very process-oriented, but I guess some of them are.
Well, they seem to take themselves very seriously, as any club might, but in this case, not really paying attention to the details of the matter, and this seems to have really, really backfired.
Point of order. Let's move on.
Yeah, please.
Enough of this. Enough of the Proud Boys. Wow. Okay, I'm sure we'll hear more about that in the news or somewhere else on the internet. We're going to talk about bookstores tonight because bookstores are something that have been near and dear to our hearts for so many years, being in the publishing world. I remember when we first put 2600 into bookstores, how amazing it was. Just showing up in places like, you remember, Tower Books and all kinds of... local establishments. I remember all the bookstores that used to exist, Shakespeare and St. Mark's, and just there were so many of them around the city, around Long Island, Oscar's, the Corner Bookshop, and just all the names are coming back to me. And then the chains came in, the chains, Borders and Barnes & Noble, and a lot of those independent stores were forced out of business. And then the chains got into trouble, and they started closing down. And now we're at a state where very few people can find a good bookstore near them. And it's really sad. There's a lot of digital content. There are a lot of people that are able to copy things onto their Kindles, but nothing replaces a book, and nothing replaces a bookstore. And that's why in New York, we're very proud of certain institutions. And I think, you know, if you asked people, especially, you know, people in the lower half of Manhattan, but I think people throughout the entire metropolitan area, if not a wider area, what the center of the universe of bookstores would be, I think many would say the Strand on Broadway, right below 14th Street. And the Strand is also in trouble, but not for the reasons you might think. I mean, I'm sure that plays a part of it as well. But this is an institution, multi-story bookstore, just filled with so much amazing content, books literally spilling out into the street. We've all seen it. We've all been there. And if you haven't been there, you have to go there and just experience what bookstores are all about. In Paris, there are still plenty of bookstores everywhere. And this is what our world used to be like, and hopefully this is what our world will be like for many years to come. But this is something that we feel strongly about, because we're all about literacy and reading and writing and spreading the word. And so that's why we're going to be talking tonight about that particular institution and what is happening right now. We have with us tonight special guest Nancy Wyden, the owner of the Strand. First of all, congratulations on owning a true treasure in New York. How long have you been involved? I've been there so many times, and I've never actually talked to people that were running the place. I just felt so small in that amazing outlet.
What an introduction! Thank you.
You're very welcome.
So the Strand has been in my family for 91 years. It was founded by my grandfather Benjamin Bass in 1927. It was a small bookstore amongst Book Row, which is an area that ran along 4th Avenue. And at its height, there were 48 bookstores. He survived the Depression, but not very well. He had at one point to live in the cot in the basement. And his wife died, and my dad and his sister were sent into foster care. But they stuck with the bookstore, and then when my dad became 13, started working there. And both my grandfather and my dad worked there up until they died. And I've worked
13.
There all my life.
Wow.
So it's been, it's you know, our family passion. We love it. We're so proud. We just want to put good books in the hands of readers.
Now, did I get it wrong? I said Broadway. Is 4th Avenue?
That was the original location. We moved in 1958 to Broadway and 12th Street. And in 1989, my dad purchased the building, which brings us to our present problem.
So, okay, you own the building. It seems that, you don't have to worry about landlords. And you have an incredible following. You have an amazing structure. You have so much content. So I guess the average person would say, well, it seems like you're home free. That, you know, all these problems that the small stores and the chains are having, you seem to have survived. But apparently, and when I heard the reason why you're in trouble, I was kind of floored by it. But it's because your building is on the verge of being labeled an historical building. Is that correct?
Yeah, they want to landmark it, which on the surface seems like a great idea, wonderful way to preserve things. But the reality is that the building is not going anywhere. It's not, no developers coming to raise it. I've been a great, I've taken great care of the building, and for over 20 years, and we've been in the location for 65 years and been in business for 91 years. And now the Landmarks people want to come with all of their rules and bureaucracy and high cost and committees and really dig in and take a part of the what I consider ownership of the building.
What is it that they could be saying that would run counter to what you're already doing? I mean, you're not tearing the building down. You're not destroying history. What is it that you're actually facing here? Alex, I know you're involved in this as well.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, we're lucky enough to be working with Nancy and Estrand on this. And, you know, part of the issue here is that when a, you know, it, as Nancy mentioned, it seems like a great idea. And most of the time, I'm sure Nancy is as well, all in favor of landmarking historical institutions. The issue here is that the Strand itself is already a cultural institution. It's already a New York landmark. And as Nancy mentioned, her father and she have taken impeccable care of this particular building, which, according to the Landmark Preservation Commission, is a perfect example of Renaissance Revival architecture from the 20th century, early 20th century. But once a building is designated as a landmark, there are a huge amount of issues that come along with it in terms of the bureaucracy that you have to deal with respect to the city. Any changes to the facade have to be approved by the Landmark Preservation Commission. And in fact, any changes you would want to make internally in the building, even if they don't affect the facade, which is really what the LPC, the Landmark Preservation Commission, is interested in landmarking, have to be approved. That adds a lot of process to this. It adds a lot of bureaucracy to it. It opens you and your plans for your business up to public scrutiny, potentially litigation. And anytime you add additional process like this, additional bureaucracy, additional permitting, you're going to need more experts. You're going to need to hire architects. You're going to need to, unfortunately, hire lawyers to deal with these processes. And
this is not something the city would pay for.
No. There are some tax-related grants and things that you can obtain from the city, which are getting that as a bureaucratic process in and of itself. However, all of this process is expensive. It's very expensive. And insofar as the Strand, they've been around for 91 years. People think they're doing really, really great. You know, it's a brick-and-mortar store. Mm-hmm. In the age of Amazon and online retailers, every brick-and-mortar store is struggling. For the Strand to exist today, they do so on very thin margins. For the Landmark Preservation Commission to decide to landmark this building, and in their draft designation report that's available to the public, or at least it should be, frankly, one of the reasons why they're trying to landmark this building is because they know and believe that the Strand is part of the cultural heritage of New York City. We all agree with that. But in trying to landmark this and designating as a landmark, they could have the unintentional but foreseeable consequence of actually destroying that which they're seeking to preserve. That's when I think the landmarking process really has to yield and think about the economic hardship, not only to Nancy as a business owner, but the Strand employs, how many people is it, Nancy?
235, and most of them are union employees.
Well,
so we support with not only them, but their families. And we need the flexibility to change with our customers. That's why we've been able to survive for 91 years. I might need to put in a coffee bar, finally succumb to things like that, need to go, you know, with changes on how we're doing our signage. I need to go through this committee, and if we have some emergency fires, floods, I'm suddenly at their mercy.
The idea of a coffee shop might sound like every other bookstore, but I think in Strand it could be really unique and different. But if you were to do something like that, that's the kind of nightmare scenario you're talking about, where you'd have to get all sorts of additional work done and surveys and permission and things mm-hmm. like that.
Well, if I want to put a side entrance in for that, mm-hmm. Different signage and.
Now, have you guys talked to anybody in the city about this, about their well-intentioned mess that they're creating?
Well, I'm a little bit of a political pawn right now, because it was all a reaction from the IT center that was on 14th Street, where de Blasio supported, and the councilwoman Rivera was supposedly not supporting, and they all caved in to the developers. And then as a compromise, they came up with hand-picking seven nearby buildings to landmark. And so I've met with everybody. I've met with landmarks. I've tried to reach out to the mayor's office, like stalking everybody. And Councilwoman Rivera, I've met with her. And, you know, so far, no help. I mean, they're kind of on their, stuck in a Kafka novel where they're into their bureaucratic ways, their
wow.
systems and committees. And
I hear that.
Hearings. That's... and yeah.
Well, and, you know, not to mention the fact, you know, and we're going to get to the point where we talk about the fact that there's going to be a public hearing on Tuesday at 9:30 a.m. at 1 Center Street on the 9th floor. We'll get to that.
We're going to get to that.
We'll
okay,
get to
good.
That.
All right.
Okay, and we hope people show up and support us at that particular public hearing. We'll get to that bit. However, what's really important to note here, too, is that there was not a hell of a lot of notice given to Nancy and the Strand about this particular process. Once they calendar a building to be designated for landmark status, you've got a couple of weeks to prepare for this. Those couple of weeks fell, you know, in between Thanksgiving and Christmas. And, you know, for any brick and mortar store, especially a bookstore like the Strand, Thanksgiving mm-hmm. and the days before it and after it are the busiest times of the year. You've got everybody on staff, everybody stretched extraordinarily thin. And then to have to prepare for a public hearing immediately following Thanksgiving is, you know, it strikes me as a bit unfair. We had tried and working with the LPC to try to get this public hearing moving. They they insist on holding this on Tuesday. And we do hope that people show up to support us for that. You know, we'll talk about how and when and where again. But we have been engaged with the LPC. They take it as part of their core mission to engage with building owners and business owners. But, you know, Nancy here is really in a unique position, too, because she's not only the proprietor of the Strand, she's also the owner of the building. So she's doubly impacted, and the employees of the Strand are going to be doubly impacted by this particular process happening at the busiest time of the year.
And not only that, but as you know, I'm not asking for anything. I'm just asking for being relieved of this bureaucratic hassle. But while I'm doing that, unlike Amazon, you know, I've never asked for any tax breaks or special favors. Then we have the richest man in America coming forth, and the city handing him $3 billion in subsidies.
Yeah, we discussed that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe I'm naive, but I really hope that that's not the way the world works.
What strikes me here, listening to the hassles that have come your way so far, we've worked with a lot of people in the court system, people facing all kinds of prosecution. It sounds like the same tactics being used to put you at a disadvantage, except you're not accused of a crime. You're doing something good. You've built an institution, and yet you're being treated in the same way, where hearings are scheduled for the worst possible time for you. All this nonsense is being thrown at you that basically makes your position weaker, hurts your business, and threatens it ultimately. And to what end? It's simply because you're stuck in this Kafka-esque nightmare, which is really disturbing to hear about.
Well, you know how I like to disagree with you. I'll actually agree with you on that. Right. Let's talk about the process.
You like to agree with me, and I know it.
Deep down, I do. But, right. You know, I'm a good lawyer. I can argue both sides. In any event, let's talk about the process. You brought it up. It's quite interesting because, yes, once this is designated, there really isn't much you can do to fight it. You can go and you can provide testimony and documentation to the LPC. That's not necessarily going to sway them with regard to the designation. And there is not really an effective legal process to contest this either, because the LPC, it's a city agency, it does what it wants. If the designation goes forward, what happens then is a political process. It's not necessarily a legal process. After the designation is finalized by the city, then only the city council can rescind or modify that designation. And it starts the clock running for 120 days. If the city council does nothing, then they've assented to that particular designation. If they decide to act on a majority basis, they can only do two. They can rescind it, so the designation would be removed entirely, or it can be modified. Like, let's say, you know, the entire site is designated as a landmark. You might be able to modify it such that, you know, only the few top floors are landmarks, something like that. And if you're not satisfied with that process, because ordinarily the city council doesn't do anything and their silence is essentially assent to the designation process, then the only legal recourse you have is to file something called an Article 78 proceeding under New York law. And that is a proceeding that would be started in New York State Supreme Court, which for those listeners that are not lawyers in New York, the Supreme Court in New York is ridiculously named because it is the lowest level court in New York.
I learned that here on this show, actually.
Yeah, wow. It's ridiculous.
The Supreme Court is the lowest court in
New
York.
The Supreme Court is the trial level state court here in New York. The Court of Appeals is the highest level. So you go to the trial level court, the Supreme Court, as it's called, and you file this Article 78 proceeding. And the only way that you can prevail on that is to prove that a city agency like the LPC, the Landmark Preservation Commission, acted arbitrarily and capriciously, which is an extraordinarily high burden to meet. Almost nobody meets that burden. Mm-hmm. It would be throwing money away to try to prove that the LPC acted arbitrarily. But then this raises...
Is there a way to say, you kind of made a mistake, we know you meant well, is there a way to say it in a less hostile manner so that maybe they'll listen?
Well, that's what we're hoping to get across at the public hearing on Tuesday, December 4th at 9:30 a.m. at 1 Center Street, near all the major subways. Further to this point, though, the issue of, hey, you got it wrong, right? You know, let's listen to reason here. Nancy brought up a really good point. The part of the reason why these buildings, there's seven buildings that have been designated for landmark status that are south of 14th Street and neighbors of the Strand, part of the reason why they've been designated for this is because of this rezoning of the so-called Silicon Alley, which, again, is a misnomer because New York doesn't really have alleys. You know, I mean, it's not like Chicago where, you put your garbage out in an alley. New York doesn't really have a lot of alleys, so it's kind of silly. In any event, the Silicon Alley redistricting, the LPC is really concerned about commercial business owners, building owners in particular, that, may own several buildings and decide that, this is a great time for us to flip this building and to sell it because a new landowner, a new building owner could raise the building to the ground, destroy the building and erect some kind of, new glass tower like we see happening all around the city. Mm-hmm. In the case of the Strand, and Nancy, you can attest to this, there's no chance of that happening. She and her father have been great stewards of this building. They're not going anywhere. Four generations of my family have been patrons of the Strand. If you think about it, my grandfather was, my mother was, I am, and my five-year-old son. We've all been to the Strand. I think Nancy can probably say here today that given the right opportunities, she would like to keep the Strand there for another 4 years. I'm sorry, another four generations, not 4 years, another four generations.
Uh-huh.
The building itself has been in such impeccable condition because they've been great stewards of it without the city becoming what is essentially a silent but, pain in the butt partner. Nobody's forced her hand to do that.
And we have no air rights and we have no, it's called FAR, no buildable space. We're overbuilt. So, and it's a loft building. Nobody's going to tear it down.
Wow. Well, this is it's so incredible to hear that these hassles are just being handed out to people who really don't deserve them. So the city council has to be has to turn this around. How many members of the city council are there, and do you need just a majority or?
There are 11 city council members, and it needs to have six of them.
That's right. Yeah. The problem with this is that, that's a political process.
Right.
Once you have this designation, you shouldn't really have to be engaged in political wrangling because what you have essentially here is the takings of a property by a governmental agency. This would be ordinarily something that could be subject to the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, that would violate the Takings Clause. But because it's a regulatory takings, for the purpose of the preservation of the cultural and historic landmarks of the city of New York, it's different and it's not necessarily considered a violation of the Fifth Amendment because the building owner still owns the building. But now you just have these additional partners, and it's the city of New York, and it becomes burdensome and expensive for people to work with the LPC, in this particular manner. Maybe not so for, high-flying commercial real estate developers who have the means to, you know, hire cadres of lawyers and consultants to work with the LPC on a regular basis whenever they need anything done to any of their buildings. But we're not talking about Nancy Wyden, commercial real estate developer. We're talking about Nancy Wyden, a bookstore owner.
And I just want to talk about, Emmanuel, about how, you know, you talked about the decline of bookstores. In 1950, in New York City, there were 368 bookstores. Then in 1981, it dropped down to 249. Today, I counted myself. There are 79 bookstores. Wow. And a lot of them are just, you know, a cookbook or a Christian bookstore, very specialized and very small bookstores. So, I mean, you know, all of our, you know, we're here in the epicenter of a cultural center, a literary center, and we need bookstores.
And those are good numbers compared to a lot of cities in America right now. It's a really sad situation. I'll bet when you go back to that initial number of over 300, there were no chains.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's true.
The chains drove out the independent bookstores and then found they couldn't support the business themselves. And what you guys have done is managed to survive all of that and prosper and just bring something unique. And, you know, Alex, when you were talking, just I don't want to make the comparison to organized crime, but boy, it sounds like a shakedown where someone says, hey, nice story you got there. Be a shame if something happened to it. And now we're your new business partners. I want to think everyone has good intentions here. Everyone wants to preserve the place, but sometimes you have to look at the process, you have to look at what you're actually doing, and you have to listen. And, you know, I guess the goal right now is to get them to listen. Well, and I think there's a hearing coming up on Tuesday where maybe they'll do that.
Yes, you might be right about that. I think Tuesday at 9:30 a.m. at 1 Center Street on the 9th floor. We would love to see people show up. We would love WBAI listeners who know the Strand, who love the Strand, to show up. We're going to have T-shirts. We're going to have some buttons to give out. I mean, look, if you show up for this public hearing and you could walk away with a T-shirt that will be, you know, an historic T-shirt.
All right. Well, that's not the reason to go to a hearing.
Well,
get a T-shirt. I mean, yeah, maybe you'll get a T-shirt.
Perhaps. Out of
it, but you want to save the Strand, for God's sake. That's what really matters here.
And Alex and I would love to meet you.
Yes.
No doubt. No doubt. Nancy's going to be speaking. I'm going to be speaking. We're going to have several authors, very well-known authors, that will be speaking on the Strand's behalf as well. We believe there's going to be some press coming out about this in the next few days. We really want to energize people to get behind the Strand, people who love the Strand and know that it's a cultural institution worth saving, but saving not in a way that's going to destroy it. I mean, you've been there for the Strand's been operating 91 years.
Yeah, I think they know what they're doing.
There's not many other things in New York that have been operating for 91 years. But to go back to your OC, your organized crime analogy here.
I didn't want to make that analogy, but you know, I can't help but feel it from what you're describing.
Well, look, there have been cases in the past, reported cases, where building owners who have not complied with the demands of the Landmark Preservation Commission and have made modifications to their building that have gone outside, you know, their bounds, have been fined substantial amounts of money for that, to the extent where, you know, the fines could actually outweigh the value of the building. This is not something that, you know, that we want to be subject to, you know, in operating, you know, New York's oldest and most well-known bookstore. And I think, you know, quite frankly, you know, the Strand and Nancy, what was the one in Portland?
Powell's Bookstore.
Powell's Bookstores. I mean, Powell's and the Strand are, I think, you know, the most well-known bookstores in the United States, if not the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, you think back to when, well, you know, 25 years ago as well, you know, bookstores were kind of crucial to the hacker community as well. I mean, this is where I learned most of everything I know about Linux and Unix, was like going into bookstores and sitting down and reading books that I couldn't afford to, you know, to purchase and were too big to steal.
Do you know how many people found out about our magazine by just wandering into a bookstore, a random bookstore, whether it's, you know, Gem Spa downtown or you know, all kinds of St. Mark's Books was another place. And the chains, too. When the chains started spreading around and displacing some of these places, our magazine was found there as well. But the same goes for books. The same goes for all sorts of you know, zine culture that thrived in that particular period of time. it means a lot to anyone who's creative, anyone who is trying to get thoughts out.
It's also a place where people can meet, people can share and get around stories or different ideas in a public way. They can get exposed to things that they ordinarily wouldn't be interested in or gravitate towards because they overheard a conversation or they were gathering with others to learn about something they never thought they'd be interested in. And places like this host events and have ways for people to get excited about learning and you know, to feed their curiosity. And with this sort of sad irony of a tech center needing sort of a mandated amount of historic buildings to ironically use the existence of this incredible institution as a reason to take control over its very footprint. It just it seems as though they're incredibly disingenuous in actually caring about the permanency of the establishment that is being used as a justification in this case. And it just really wouldn't be a very supportive move on behalf of the city to use the history and the family business that has thrived there for so long and not participate in a meaningful way as far as supporting their interests and really listening as any business would expect from the city.
We're here tonight speaking with Nancy Wyden, owner of New York's esteemed Strand Bookstore. It's been in the family since the 1920s. You can call in if you have questions for her, for us, 212-209-2877. And we'd like to hear from you. Nancy, could you maybe give us, for the sake of listeners who might not have gone to the Strand, or for the sake of our listeners in other parts of the world, a floor-by-floor representation of what's in the Strand? Because, you know, I've spent an afternoon just wandering around and discovering all sorts of things. How many floors are there to start with?
There are four floors. Our slogan is 18 miles of books, and we say get lost in the stacks.
And that doesn't count outside, too, because there's books in the street.
Right. People love our carts, our bargain carts, and frankly, there's just so much good books out there. I'm constantly wondering, but we know the shelves are clogged inside, so sometimes we just have to release them to the outside. But there are dollar books, $2 books out there, 48-cent books. Inside, you come into, you know, fiction. Every subject is there. On the second floor is art books and kids books, and in the basement, music, philosophy, religion, even mathematics and science. And then on our fourth floor, third floor is the rare book room, which we have a gold vault with precious books in there. And we do events. We have at least two or three a day. And so that's so important in this culture of technology where we're just losing this humanness, to sit down, actually be with people, be with the authors that are speaking to you, meet people. We've had plenty of marriages there, marriage proposals, bar mitzvahs,
wow,
fun, happy occasions, people getting together, ideas coming to life.
That rare book section is simply unbelievable. If you've not been there, just going there and just drinking it all in, the history, the years that many of these. Can you give an example of the type of material that you'd find up there?
We have, first edition Alice in Wonderland. We have a complete set of Mark Twain, signed as Mark Twain or Samuel Clemens, and then some of it's very affordable. Sometimes people are intimidated. Maybe a $20 book that's just signed by first edition mystery book that's signed by an author. We have Bill Clinton's latest book signed by him and Patterson. It's $100. That's the fun of it, because we buy and use books all the time. You never know what you're going to really find there.
Uh-huh. All right, we have a phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Can you speak up? You're coming in rather poorly.
Can you hear me now?
That's better, yes.
Okay, good. Well, first, high commendation to the institution that the Strand Bookstore is. And I can't, if I probably, if I summed up the time I spent there during my lifetime, it would come to several months. And of course, we want to see it prosper and continue, but I think here we're conflating two separate good entities and pitting them against each other, which a good lawyer would do. But I believe that Alex, in the process, is poisoning the well, and the well is the Landmark Preservation Commission. Now, the Landmark Preservation Commission was instituted because Penn Station was demolished, and if it hadn't been instituted, Grand Central would have followed suit. I come from the opposite end of the political process because I'm always trying to get the attention of the Landmark Preservation Commission, and believe me, it's not an easy thing. I find it hard to believe that they wouldn't give you the relief which you're asking, which, if I understand correctly, one of the things that I heard tonight is that you would like a postponement of the hearing. And I can see why they wouldn't do that. They keep postponing things that I have in front of them all the time. So with the good reasons that you have and the public attention that hopefully this program will suscitate and more, I don't see why you shouldn't have that relief. Now, as far as being an impediment to any changes to the building, unfortunately, I have personal experience. Being a landmark is no impediment whatsoever to even the architectural integrity of the building. I think you could still put in your cafe, you could still make modifications, including a side entrance, which has been done. I have a perfect example. Everybody knows the Puff Building downtown, which is a monument. And that one has a side entrance. It's made for a high-ticket restaurant that I fought for years, and no one is better than I live. So it's not a matter of, you know, being impeded by the city, which, to be sure, as you know, as a building owner, impedes at every step of the way. But the matter of the fines that go over the value of the building, that's ridiculous. I mean, Alex, maybe you don't have much experience with this kind of cases, but I can tell you that anything that includes buildings, when it's in front of the city, fines are reduced to nothing all the time, all the time. And I say this from the opposite end, not as a building owner, but as somebody who would like to see some discipline when it comes to regulation being followed by building owners. And I have a lot more to say, and I hope that this goes to a good end, because I don't see the necessity of the fight that you're describing.
Okay, well, thanks very much for your call. We're going to let Alex and Nancy respond on air. Our number 212-209-2877. Good. Go ahead, Alex.
Sure.
Well, my mic is on. Fantastic. To go to the caller's first point with regard to the relief that we had requested, which was to adjourn the meeting for a short date, that was denied. They want to march forward with this particular public hearing on the 4th of December at 1 Center Street, 9:30 a.m. on the 9th floor. We hope that a lot of people will show up and support us at that particular public hearing. We had a lot of great reasons for that to be postponed, and I'm sorry that your meetings keep getting postponed and adjourned, but this particular public hearing has not been. And it could be because there are, I believe, six other buildings that were designated as potential landmarks as well, and they want to move forward with all of these in that same particular district on this particular day. So, yeah, we expected to get some kind of delay, some kind of relief, and we did not get that at all. You know, and this is a process that's been going on for, you know, 3.5 months. So, you know, with respect to the other issue, which is the, you know, well, buildings can get done what they want to get done when it comes to alterations and changes, you know. But yes, yeah, you know, nobody's contesting that it can't get done. We're contesting the manner in which it has to be done and the process that you have to go through and the bureaucracy and the additional permitting.
The caller mentioned the Puck Building, which, you know, we're familiar with because we had a conference there.
I remember.
The Beyond Hope Conference in 1997. And now, I believe, Kyle, it's run by REI, a Seattle company.
Oh, yeah. Why are you looking at me?
You're from Seattle.
Okay, yeah, I know REI. They
did a really good job with that building. They preserved the history, but I get the impression they spent a ton of money doing that.
There's a lot of, like,
plaques and exhibitions talking about what the building had been used for
and I
previously.
Think that's,
but
yeah,
that
that's,
was a part of the renovation.
That's what will happen if the other building that we have our conference is in the Hotel Pennsylvania. I know we spent a lot of time trying to get the attention of the Landmarks Commission because when they were thinking of tearing that down, we wanted to preserve it. That's not what's happening here. We're not talking about a building that's in danger of being torn down.
No.
And by the way, the caller is right in saying that you can't get their attention. They, you know, we never did get their attention. This is something different because, yeah, you have their attention, but it's not yeah. wanted attention.
Now you don't want it. Yeah, but, you know, so to go back to the caller's points, which I take to heart, and I think he made a reasonable argument here, you know, this process as well can also be misused. There can be a misuse and abuse of this particular permitting process when you're looking for something like a certificate of no effect or a certificate of appropriateness to do something, you know, let's say even to the internal structure of the building that would have no implications whatsoever to the facade. That can be misused by the public. People can chime into the LPC and raise, you know, nonsensical concerns. This can then extend the process. Then you may need to hire additional experts. Then you may need to hire more lawyers or more consultants to deal with the LPC. So, yes, I agree with the caller. You can get done what you want to get done, but can you get done what you want to get done in a reasonable time and for a reasonable cost? And for people like Nancy and the Strand, this is doubly impactful because she's not only the building